Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
This is Serious Privacy. Here are your hosts, Paul Breitbart and Kay Royal.
Earlier this week, we released a special episode on the UK Data Protection and Digital Information Bill. But today, you get the episode we actually intended for you this week. A regular Week in Privacy episode, where Kay and I talk about the EU-US Data Privacy Framework, also known as the Thingy, US state law developments, cookie banners, and also about a call for updates to the BCR mechanism. Lots to discuss, as always. My name is Paul Breitbart.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. Paul and I are actually, y'all have no idea, getting a little late recording today because there is so much going on in the privacy world. We're like, what are we going to narrow it down to talk to? But I will say, Paul, right after we do the serious question, the unexpected question, that we've had suggestions that at the beginning of each podcast, maybe we should take a minute and just call out the happenings in privacy that week. Don't discuss them, just call them out in case someone didn't see them and they need to go look at them. That might be something we look at doing. I don't know.
Could be if we think about it, actually.
Yeah.
And I also don't want to do the copy-paste of what Angelique is doing in her podcast with the 4-minute weekly overview.
Exactly. No. Don't want to do an overview. Just want to say, hey, did you catch the story on Amazon this week? Nope. And I saw the one on Facebook. Boom, done. All right. So, unexpected question. How did you start your day?
By waking up.
Don't make me reach through the phone and slap someone.
I mean, that's the honest answer.
Funny enough, me too.
After that, coffee and the edit of last week's episode.
Ah, there you go. So,
because I had not gotten to that over the weekend, which I usually try to do.
I saw that.
So I started this morning because it needs to go out today.
Yes, and I will dive in after this and do as much as I possibly can. So that's how my morning should have started. But my morning started with, what did I do? Actually, this is my morning. I had breakfast and coffee, and that's about it. So I'm at the beginning of my morning. I don't like to do anything before 9 a.m. I'm just saying.
Yeah, well, on days that I go to the office, I have to do things before 9 a.m. because my train is at 7:33. So,
well, I say that, but I lay in bed on my phones and I answer emails and Slack messages and I look up things and everything, as well as I'm, you know, reading my vampire angel romance books, because why read nonfiction?
Where are the days that people could just start their day with a paper, broadsheet newspaper, and a cup of coffee, right?
Right. That's the perfect start. But I will say, speaking of books, and I won't say melt just on this, I did post that my book is live on Kindle as an ebook. It is GDPR in the USA, just a short guidebook. It doesn't pretend to solve all your problems. It's just a quick reference to open up if you follow GDPR to say, oh, goodness, what do I need to do in the US if I'm dealing with children's data or health data or education data and some of the crossovers there. I am turning it into a paperback, but I'm going to add more information in the paperback because I want it to be thick enough to have a spine.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to add more pages. So I'll work on that. Maybe I'll have some I can actually bring to IAPP. But otherwise, if y'all have a question, let me know. I mean, it's a little bit over $5, maybe almost $6. It's not that expensive. I don't expect to get rich on this.
Well, you may want to also look at other options than just the Kindle version or the EPUB version or something like that.
That is true. Because I do have it in the electronic version, I think, to upload to those. So I'll look and see what that is. Because, yes, I've had quite a few people say they don't use Kindle. So I'll have to.
Big bad Amazon, right? So
yeah, that's true. I didn't even think about that. I was like, I've only ever read on Kindle for years. So the Kindle app on my phone, not an actual Kindle. But speaking of that, here's a very serious question. I want one of the digital notebooks. And I've been looking at Remarkable, Supernote, and the Kindle Scribe. Even though the Kindle Scribe has a lot more storage, I think I'm down to the Remarkable and the Supernote. Do you have experience with either one or another suggestion?
I have not. So far, I've been using a large screen iPad for all those kind of things.
Yep.
With a pencil that also works well. I've seen Remarkable. I really like Remarkable. The only thing I don't like about it is that it doesn't have a backlight.
Mm-hmm. The Scribe does.
Which, if there is no light or if there is a low light situation, that's hard.
It's very hard to do that. That makes sense. I'll look and see if the Supernote has that. I don't know. I know the Scribe does. Okay. And if any of our listeners have any suggestions, let me know. Up until this point, I've been using the Erasable paper notebook, the Rocket Book. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting a little tired of, I've had it for a few years now, of wiping all the pages down. So I thought about something like that. Y'all holler at me if y'all have a recommendation. Let's dive into a week of privacy. Meanwhile, we'll also see if we can't get hold of Ralph and tie him in here to speak to the UK before we come out. But what else do we have going on in the world?
So, well, there is this thingy. And we mentioned in a previous episode that the EDPB opinion is out. We just have not yet really discussed it. So it might be good to start with that one.
Okay. Hit us with it.
So the European Data Protection Board issued their opinion on the EU-US Data Privacy Framework, as it is officially called, on February 28th. And basically, as expected, there are positives and there are negatives, but they don't fully endorse or embrace the framework yet. They certainly see substantial improvements, such as the introduction of requirements on necessity and proportionality for US intelligence data gathering and clarity that's been given. But there are still concerns, especially because bulk collection is still possible. They are not completely convinced about the oversight mechanism and also on the commercial aspects. There are still some concerns left that are to some extent still linked to the self-certification model. It is about definitions that do not match GDPR. We have also discussed before. And also still onward transfers is an issue because that has not been ruled out as part of the framework. So also there, what would happen if the data is being transferred?
Right. And the onward transfers is just a big problem for US companies to wrap their heads around.
Yeah, and I think this is the key problem almost every adequacy decision that you implement. We know that Japan, as part of the mutual adequacy decision, imposed some restrictions. I think Korea did too. And I think this will be an argument for basically every single adequacy decision going forward.
Yeah, I agree. And even now when people ask you or companies ask you to do a transfer impact assessment and they ask you, are you or any of your sub-processors subject to laws that might cause you to disclose information to the government? Yeah.
Yeah, that is for every single company. The answer will always be yes. The question is, what are the circumstances
right.
under it's which like, you should do so? Is that on the basis of a subpoena that has been approved by a court? Is that just a request from law enforcement to provide information as part of an ongoing inquiry?
Yeah.
There are many different options.
And many companies fall under third-party doctrine that law enforcement can go to them to get the information because third-party doctrine, longstanding decisions have held that once a person throws their data away or gives it to someone else, it is no longer their data and they no longer have a right to privacy. Mm-hmm. Now, this has been limited somewhat when it comes to banks. You know, saying, well, people don't have a choice but to give their information to a bank if they want to have a bank account. It's the same way for pretty much anything. Cell phones, you wouldn't.
And it would be the same for governments, as we discussed last week with Emma Martins, because you don't have a choice to change government.
Exactly.
Well, you have a choice to change government. You usually do that via elections unless you storm the Capitol or something. But in principle, you do so via elections. But still, you only have one government per country.
Exactly. Well, you hope you only have one, or you're in a very bad country.
True. Let's not go down that route.
Yeah, but it is. So it's a big problem. And here's the thing. Almost all companies in the U.S. are going to use either Google or Microsoft, especially for things like documents and spreadsheets and PowerPoint slides, which may or may not ever have, you know, other people's information on it. But regardless, they have something that they use to create communications on, be it email, documents, whatever. And so most all companies use one or the other. I mean, you have very few options otherwise. And the same thing of backing up in either the OneDrive or the Google Drive. And yes, there are corporate accounts for Google and everything. So yes, your sub-processors are subject.
Yes.
That doesn't mean that your data falls under that.
Absolutely not. And I mean, the EDPB also has some concerns about the oversight on the US side, lack of prior authorization, for example, for bulk collection.
Why would they worry about that?
Well, because it's fairly common to have such prior authorizations in some EU member states. So I think that's why it's there. And also about the effectiveness of the PCLOB. I think in general, they are okay with PCLOB oversight.
They just have to get better.
Yeah, they just have to get better and basically do more. And of course, we know that there is always the risk every time there is a change of administration that the PCLOB goes without members for a couple of years and then cannot do anything because they don't have a quorum.
And they're not viewed as being an active body. They're viewed in a lot of ways as being a very passive body. So I get it.
So this is the opinion of the EDPB, not completely unexpected, I would say. It's also fairly in line with what the EDPB said, or the Working Party 29 said about the privacy shield when that was discussed in draft. And I can only hope, actually, that the European Commission this time around will actually listen to the criticism, because they don't tell the European Commission, go back to the negotiation table and start from scratch. They ask for certain clarifications, for better explanations. They worry that the whole set of documents with, I don't know, it's about a dozen different documents with cross-references and this goes together with that, and that it is not transparent enough. So they call for better transparency in how the framework is presented and listing what are the criteria for people to work with it actually on a daily basis. All those kind of things can be done that wouldn't require a whole new series of fights between parentheses with the United States. It is just something that the Commission can work on to clarify.
Yeah.
And I really hope that they do, because otherwise we have the list of arguments for the court already ready on why also the thingy, the data privacy framework, would not be sufficient to stand the adequacy test.
So it's kind of like giving them a roadmap to what they need to do to improve it in order to avoid being killed.
Yes, I think so. I think so. And while we are on the page of the PCLOB, I think there is some important movement also on the US side with Travis LeBlanc calling for better common sense protections, especially with regard to Section 702 in FISA.
Yeah.
With the forthcoming reauthorization, he apparently said that earlier this week at Cybersecurity 202, the Washington Post quotes him on that. And I think that is an important step, even though he mainly calls for better protection of U.S. persons. I think an overall higher level of protection of FISA 702 will also have its impact on non-U.S. persons.
Yeah. Agreed. Agree. We like Travis LeBlanc.
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do. He seems to bring a good common sense, practical approach to things and doesn't put it in language that most people can't understand.
If you have no idea who Travis is, listen to one of the episodes from season one. We'll link in the show notes.
Absolutely.
When Travis was still at the FCC.
Exactly. And that's how I remember him most is my first, I can't call it a meeting. My first time that I'd really seen him was on stage. I think it was him and Julie Brill. and he wore these really crazy socks that I absolutely loved. And you couldn't help but notice them because, you know, he was right up on stage sitting down. But someone asked him the difference between the FCC and the FTC when it comes to privacy enforcement. And FCC used to be pretty strong in it. But again, things change from administration to administration, their priorities and where they focus. And he said it's kind of like the Justice League and I don't know what's the other. It's like DC and Marvel. They're both out to fight evil.
See my blank face here.
I was seeing your...
This is comic books, right?
Yep. Yep. It's Superman, Batman, you know, all that good stuff.
Okay. Those names ring a bell. That actually helps.
It's the two big sides. And it's really good. Superman and Batman are both on the same team, by the way.
And both sides have good ones and bad ones, right? It's not that one is all good and the other is all bad.
Yeah, both sides have their heroes, both sides have their villains. And then of course there's Disney, which seems to own every genre out there.
And is generally perceived as villainous or not villainous?
Disney? It depends, because the princesses are considered, they're most famous. The princesses and Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck are all considered, you know, the good side. But they're the ones that also have Maleficent.
That's you.
And Star Wars. So, yeah, there's a lot of villains. I like it. So, yeah. What else you got going on that side of the world?
Oh, well, you know these cookie banner things?
Oh, God.
You remember the discussion we had back in January of 2022 on the IAB transparency and consent framework?
Yes, I do.
Well, that discussion is back.
Why?
I think.
Why is it back?
Well, as we discussed already a couple of weeks ago, apparently there is an agreement, or at least there is an updated version of the TCF that the IAB has submitted to the Belgian DPA as
right.
part of the whole enforcement process. IAB claims sign off. The Belgian DPA says, no, we do not sign off, but we have said that we see the improvement and for the rest, we'll wait for the court to decide. But IAB apparently behind the scenes is starting to talk about this and push this out. So there are consultancies on consent management platforms now also talking about it on social media more. And the one thing that strikes me is that there is still discussion about legitimate interest with relation to cookie banners.
And I don't get that.
Neither do I.
I mean, you broke it down for me very simply years ago into why the TCF and legitimate interest is completely unfounded and unworthy and should never even be a thought when it comes to cookie banners.
So let's see if you paid attention.
Yes, yes. Ralph has also hammered it in on me, but you can't. You cannot use legitimate interest for a cookie banner because cookies, for one, are essentially based on consent. You either consent or you don't consent to be tracked or analyzed or whatever the heck it is these cookies do other than what is strictly necessary to run the website. Some of the functional ones are a little questionable too because they're not necessarily mm-hmm. strictly limited to function. But you should have the option whether or not you want to be tracked and you want them to deposit a piece of software deposited without your consent in order to track all this. And I agree, legitimate interest should never be a basis of it because you're essentially taking away people's rights to how they want their information to be tracked and used.
Well, there is one other reason, and that is because cookies are based on e-privacy, and e-privacy does not have a legitimate interest legal basis in the text.
That is true.
And the European member states may want it in the e-privacy regulation. That's still being debated. I saw a tweet.
Crazy after all these years.
Well, I mean, I saw a tweet from the European Parliament rapporteur last week who really, it was clear she had a very deep sigh and said, I'm working continuously to get this done, but the member states are not willing to play. You know, there is no e-privacy regulation. And also there, for legitimate interest, the rapporteur has said, over my dead body, that legitimate interest will be included. So also in the future, there will not be legitimate interest for cookies.
As long as anybody with the same mind has any say over it, there is an e-privacy directive. Don't get us wrong. There is a directive, mm-hmm. but they're trying to modify it, turn it into the e-privacy regulation. So it will have the same general effect that the GDPR does, which
exactly.
came from Directive 95. But I agree, legitimate interest should never be a basis when it comes to tracking people, especially if it's across websites.
Yeah. And there are these consultants now that say, hey, maybe you should do a legitimate interest assessment for cookies, because then you find out that legitimate interest is not possible. Why do an assessment for something that isn't the legal basis in the first place? It's really mind-boggling. But,
you know, it kind of has a crazy sense of logic, because he's saying, all right, you companies who think you have a legitimate interest in it, if you won't accept our fundamental tenets that there isn't, fine, then go down the route and do your legitimate interest. But if you do it right, it won't be allowed. Come at it from every direction possible, right? But no, it's true. It boggles the mind, but it is. And of course, our old friend Alexander Hanf is on the warpath on cookies anyway. So if you...
And then you have the whole discussion. Some people claim in that the IAB intends that legitimate interest only is about the further processing of the cookie data once you have obtained the user consent to set the cookie in the first place.
That you have a legitimate interest for secondary use of the data?
Yeah. Look at the provision on secondary use. Also there is no legitimate interest.
It's like, interesting.
People creating legal basis out of thin air, and I have no idea how they do it.
Well, and I wonder if it comes from the fact that secondary use is allowed, if it is primarily, well, I can't say primarily because it's not, what's the word for it? If it's essentially related to the same purpose and a natural derivative of the same person, the person gave you the same purpose, the person gave you the consent for to begin with, that's not legitimate interest.
No.
You may actually have a legitimate interest in it, but not as a legal basis. But there we go. There we go. Okay.
So that was my rant for this week on a very familiar topic, of course.
Well, you know, let's go on and look and see what we have in the U.S. We've got a very, very busy legislative season right now. Of course, we know that there is always talk on the federal hill about a federal privacy law. I don't remember what the latest acronym was that they came up with, but it apparently has been a hot topic in some very major committees. It's, I believe, passed out of committee. They're looking at it. It's still a bipartisan bill, but it's getting hung up.
Could it be the NGH?
It might be.
They're never going to happen?
I'm thinking so. It could very well be. Watch them come up with an acronym to actually make that fit. But regardless, they're trying, but guess what's hanging them up? Preemption.
California?
Yes. Preemption and a private right of action. Oh, who would have thought that those two would have been important aspects? But
I mean, I'm in privacy for what, 15 years now? I've been hearing those two topics as the core issue in the U.S. for those 15 years?
Forever. So that's what we have. But right now we have 20 states with proposed omnibus.
Sorry, what is it? What is it that the U.S. is actually scared of when it comes to preemption? Why is it that the U.S. is scared about preemption where Europe is not?
I don't know. The wild, wild west?
Because we allow Germany to be more strict. We allow
France,
Italy and France to make their additional rules when they think there is a real need to do so. Why shouldn't California be able to? Or why shouldn't New York or Washington or Alaska, for that matter, be able to say, well, we think this is, in our local situation, really important, so we want to have some additional rules here?
Well, actually, they don't prevent that. A great example of that is HIPAA in the U.S. with healthcare and the California medical records confidentiality law. The states are allowed to have laws that are more protective than the federal, as long as they're not addressing the exact same thing. So California has it because it addresses companies that might not qualify as covered entities or business associates, because they don't do the 11 transactions. They protect it just based on healthcare. So it's not the exact same basis for the law.
No.
I just wonder when they line up, and people have done this before, they line up the aspects of the ADPA thing with the California, with the CCPA, and have shown where the differences are. The problem is they're speaking to the same controls. They're just taking different levels of protection to them. And that's what's not permitted. So, yeah. So it's interesting how it works. But yeah, all I can say is it's got to be the wild, wild west. We just like to be very independent. Our states are as big as other multinational areas, countries, and they just like to do their own thing for their own people. But I have a faith. I have faith that something will come out of it. The problem is it's going to be something that's weak and watery and it's not really going to matter, which is California's concern. If the ADPPA provided the same level of protection that the CCPA did in every category and in every way, there would probably be no argument over it. But the federal is not going to do that. So it's going to be interesting. But we do have 20 states that have laws proposed, which is interesting because, you know, one of them's already killed in session. That's Mississippi. I have to go in and eventually figure out why it was already killed. But I think it was essentially the same thing that was proposed the last time that eventually died. So they just killed it early this time. But we do have others that we're watching. And one of the ones that's really making the news is Washington, and not for its omnibus bill, but because it actually has a bill to protect healthcare data. And this comes specifically in response to the Dobbs decision. And so they really want to protect the healthcare data, especially that of the sale of private reproductive healthcare data, kind of like what Texas is restricting. So it wants to present tax on that because they say right now from the data brokers, you can, you know, pay $160 for a woman's search history from a data broker. So if she was on her private computer or phone and was searching, you would be able to buy that search history. And I agree, that stinks. So that is interesting. And that data is usually not protected under HIPAA. A lot of people are like, but you have a law that protects healthcare data. Not that healthcare data, not healthcare data in general. Healthcare data that's used by covered entities and by business associates through those covered entities, yes. But if they don't qualify under HIPAA, which someone's search engine history would not, it would be. But speaking of that, that does remind me of the lawsuits against Metapixel, and how it is transitioning. And there was a decision that just came down about an app that allowed the Metapixel to scrape up the data from that. It was either an app or a website from that. And I'll get the details of that one. But it allowed you to scrape up that data and it contained very sensitive health information. And because the company allowed these trackers on their app or their website when they should have known that it was going to transition, which was actually protected health information, to Facebook, that they're held accountable. So that was good. So we are starting to see a few more things. One of the other ones that I will say is, let's see.
So when we talk about other ones, how many are we talking about?
What do you mean?
How many state laws are in progress right now?
Oh, we have 20. We have got bills proposed in 20 states, and they range from West Coast to East Coast. I can list off the names real quickly. It's Washington, Oregon, Montana, Texas, Hawaii, Oklahoma, Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia. Then you're moving into the Northeast, the D.C., Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, and New York.
So which are the 30 that are missing?
They're the ones in gray on the map. And you can track these real easily. Two really great sources here. We've got the IAPP that does their state tracking, but you've also got Hush Blackwell, which does a wonderful tracking as well. Year after year, they have that too. So you do have that. Great resources. We'll make sure to list there in there.
So any of those that have been adopted yet? I know it's early. It's still early. It's March, but
I don't think so. Let's see. So, no.
Or killed, for that matter.
The ones that are yellow are the ones that we already have passed, the Virginia, Connecticut, Colorado, Utah, and California. So, we do have some interesting things going on with the Texas law as well. There have been some decisions and some lawsuits filed. So, this is really interesting. There are, and by the way, I want to come back to a couple of stories that I also saw in the news. But under Texas, there was a decision that the the funds that are available, that have been available from reproductive clinics, things like that, to help someone get out of state in Texas so they can have it, are probably safe from prosecution. Did have a federal judge on that one ruled that the abortion funds, the people who provide the funds, cannot be criminally charged. And I know a lot of employers had looked into that issue as well, that if their insurance benefits paid for someone to travel out of state, would they be held criminally liable? So looks like they're going to be safe there. However, there are five women who have filed a lawsuit in Texas because they were denied abortions, even though it was medical reasons. They have filed a suit for that because there should be some sort of protection there. They were wanted. They were not elective abortions that needed to happen. There were medical reasons. And in at least one case, because of the medical emergency she was under, there was no chance the fetus would survive her emergency condition, but they still would not let her abort.
Wow.
They forced her to go through it for her body. So it's...
I think that's really, really sad.
And then there is a new bill saying that abortion websites would be blocked in Texas under a new bill. It would require the internet service providers to block sites that provide abortion information, as well as making it illegal to host or provide domain registration for sites that help people obtain or pay for abortions. If that one passes, there is something wrong with the democratic system, because that just seems wrong. But there we go. They would be required to make every reasonable and technologically feasible effort to block internet access to information intended to assist or facilitate efforts to obtain an elective abortion or an abortion-inducing drug. And it lists out places they have to block: Aid Access, Hey Jane, Plan C, Choix, Just the Pill, and Carafum. And there are others that it would as well. And it provides legal immunity for denial of service to people who aid or abet abortion, encouraging TSPs to kick users offline, as well as they are taking a bounty hunter approach to finding websites and apps that help this. So this is
sad.
Our nation right now.
This is really, really sad.
So yeah, so that's something that's really happening here in the United States. Sometimes crazy. And we try not to get into very political, controversial topics here, despite the fact that privacy is apparently a very politically controversial topic in some areas. But yeah, so we'll keep a watch on what that's doing. One of the stories I wanted to go back to was Bowana Bellamy. We've had on the show before, wrote an op-ed saying that maybe it's time to rethink binding corporate rules, which surprised me. I had to go read it. It surprised me because binding corporate rules are considered, you know, the gold standard of protection. And I was the first person at the company that filed a dual application for binding corporate rules for processors and controllers. Processors technically called binding safe processor rules, but essentially the same thing. So I'm intimately familiar with the effort it takes for the BCRs. But she said that the EDPB missed an opportunity to address BCRs in a systematic, strategic, and forward-thinking way, and to enable this important transfer mechanism to evolve into a more scalable, powerful, and globally relevant tool for sustainable international data transfers.
I'm not sure whether I'm convinced this is a new message.
Ah, you think this has been a long-standing message, huh?
I'm not completely convinced this is a new message. The Center for Information Policy Leadership has been looking at BCRs for a long time, advocating their use, not just as a transfer mechanism, but also as an accountability mechanism. And I agree, it is a great accountability mechanism. It is much more than just a transfer tool. But by just saying, well, BCRs are great, and look at how good the companies that have BCRs are doing privacy. Sure, that is true, but that doesn't make it more easy to use BCRs as a transfer tool or in business-to-business relationships. And let's not forget...
Or even to get an approval.
Even to get an approval, many DPAs are backlogged on approving BCRs. And let's also not forget, BCRs are very expensive. So
they are. They are very expensive.
They are suitable for a handful of very large multinationals.
There's only like a little over 100 companies that have ever gotten
it's about 200.
About 200 now?
Yeah.
So still a handful, 200 companies.
Yeah.
That's a handful. And she says that to fully recognize the potential of BCRs, policymakers need to promote, incentivize, and recognize their special nature. As Paul was just saying, BCRs are expensive. They're hard to implement. They take a lot of time and attention and focus to do. Essentially, an enforceable corporate code of conduct. And I absolutely agree with that. My problem is, and you and I have talked about this before, now that companies have gone through these extensive negotiations for DPAs, you know, to put in SECs in place and the APIC cross-border privacy rules and all of that, are they going to let go of it and just say, oh, companies who have BCRs are fine? In my experience, I've seen they still want to negotiate the heavy DPAs and everything rather than saying we'll abide by your BCRs. They need to be simplified and transform the approval process. Yes, the approval burden on it. They did simplify it back when we were doing it. It went to your primary authority and two secondary ones, but still it's crazy. Sure, a risk-based approach to risk assessment, something that I believe in, something that Paul believes in. We've heard other privacy experts say you should not take a risk-based approach. That seems to be bonkers to me. You should always take a risk-based approach. Make BCRs interoperable and mutually recognized across jurisdictions. That I do like, but I feel that piece in particular is in direct response to trying to globalize the CBPRs as a global standard of data transfer. So I think that's interesting. How they work together should be good. There is a wonderful crosswalk out there between CBPRs and BCRs. Compares if you have one, what you need to have in place to do the other. It has been historically easier in my experience to get the CBPRs first and then crosswalk over to the BCRs. But companies take different approaches. And then recognize transfers from BCR to BCR approved companies.
It's not in the GDPR.
Yeah.
So the board can say all at once, but it is not there as a legal basis. So
yeah,
I don't know how you want to do that without legislative change.
Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting. I do appreciate that there's a lot of moving elements in this. And as big of a commercial player as the U.S. is, it's not playing the role it should when it comes to cross-border transfers of personal data.
No, not as we would like to see it.
No.
And the CBPRs, I mean, they've existed for, well over a decade?
Yeah.
And also there, it's just a handful of companies that adhere to the mechanism.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll see. To be continued. So that's what we have this week in privacy. It's quite a lot. And for now, thank you very much for listening to yet another episode of Serious Privacy. Like and review us in your favorite podcast app. We see some very nice reviews coming in, so thank you for that. Join the conversation on LinkedIn. Look for Serious Privacy. Find us on social media elsewhere. Kay as Heart of Privacy, myself as Drew Fulby. Until next week, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.